Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in Washington today for his first face-to-face meeting with President Donald Trump. The two leaders are expected to discuss trade, a potentially thorny issue given Trump's criticism of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Trump has called for a renegotiation of that deal. The U.S., though, is Canada's biggest trading partner by far, and some Canadian executives say changes to that relationship could hurt major industries on both sides of the border. For more, we're joined now by Jen Skerritt, agricultural reporter with Bloomberg News. She's based in Winnipeg. Welcome, Jen.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, when President Trump talks about NAFTA, usually people presume that he is talking about U.S. trade with Mexico and slamming companies essentially that send jobs to Mexico. But help us understand, what does NAFTA mean, or how significant is it for Canada?
It's very significant. Canadians are very much intertwined with the U.S. economy and have been for the last 30 years since NAFTA was signed. So the U.S. is Canada's biggest trading partner. Pretty much all of Canada's oil goes to the States, and a lot of the manufacturing is really geared toward U.S. demand. So any change to NAFTA would definitely have a huge impact here in Canada.
Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, how much of Canada's GDP, how many jobs, you know, what kind of volume of trade are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about $541 billion worth of trade. So, I mean, numerous sectors, autos, oil, those are big ones. But also, you know, metals, mining, kind of everything in between. So Canada's very hugely dependent on the U.S. economy, and vice versa. You know, some economists have pointed out that many jobs in the U.S. are also very dependent on free trade with Canada and Mexico, and there's probably about 5 million U.S. jobs that depend on NAFTA as well. So kind of goes both ways, but definitely Canada has very big ties here to the U.S.
Right. I mean, I'm seeing from your reporting that shipments from Canada to the United States account for more than 75% of Canada's total exports. So when President Trump talks about renegotiating or changing the terms of NAFTA, how does that go over in Canada?
Well, you know, Canadian executives have pointed out how key the U.S. is as a trading partner and just how important the bilateral ties really are. I guess what no one knows at this point is just, you know, what the terms of the renegotiation will look like. So some people have said, you know, it could be positive for some companies that maybe, like oil companies, that President Trump has been positive on things like the Keystone XL, and obviously much of Canada's oil, most of it goes to the U.S. So they're thinking that on the energy front, there could be some positive there. But definitely on the manufacturing side, you know, automakers, for example, have pointed out, you know, this is going to raise the price of vehicles if barriers are erected and that trade can't flow as easily as it could before.
Because there's something like just under $90 billion of motor vehicle and other transportation Canadian exports to the United States every year.
It's huge. For example, I think just automakers and oil and gas producers together last year generated about $60 billion in shipments. So that's huge. It's a huge number. And basically any cost or additional tax or a tariff on these exports to the States will just, you know, raise the cost of those products. Mm-hmm. So even for something like mining, the industry has said, you know, raising the cost of those raw materials actually will also increase the cost of U.S. production. So for something like nickel imports, that just means U.S. manufacturers that use it in steel production, you know, their costs go up too. So it's not just Canadian side that's going to be hit with that. There's kind of a domino effect here that's at play. So
yeah, interesting. So you mentioned mining, we talked about transportation, and you talked about the energy sector as well. So overall, it's a rather complicated picture in terms of Canada's view of NAFTA. How is this playing out in Ottawa? I mean, where does this put Prime Minister Trudeau in terms of what his view is of every time President Trump says something disparaging about the North American Free Trade Agreement?
Well, it seems like so far Trudeau has been fairly conciliatory, you know, has just said they're willing to work with the administration. They're both, you know, both Trudeau and Trump were elected to work on behalf of the middle class. So he hasn't criticized the president, and it sounds like going into today's meeting is going to be really just underscoring the importance of that relationship, which is obviously super important for the economy and for jobs and for trade. So, you know, obviously need to maintain that relationship with the U.S.
Well, Jen Skerritt is a reporter with Bloomberg News. She's based in Winnipeg. Jen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Evacuation orders are still in place for the nearly 200,000 people living below the Oroville Dam in Northern California. But the good news? This is the second largest reservoir in the state, water the dam holds back, and those water levels are falling. The evacuation order came late yesterday afternoon when water spilled over the dam into one emergency spillway, which burst a hole, and then into a second spillway, which threatened to break and flood the area. Today, officials hope to plug the first spillway break with rocks carried by helicopters. John Sepulvedo is host of the California Report on KQED, a Here and Now contributor. So, John, are these structural infrastructure problems with the spillway which burst a hole? Or is this because there's been so much rain that maybe nothing could have held that water?
Well, there's been a ton of rain. The fact that somebody hasn't just built up an ark and started gathering animals two by two is pretty amazing. We have not seen this type of rain in Northern California in many years, as I'm sure Here Now listeners are very aware of. There's been a big drought in California, so that's part of it. The ground is essentially can't absorb all the water that's falling. The second part is that this actual spillway, so there's the dam that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. That dam is the second largest, as you said, in the state, and it needs to reach about 900 feet high, full of water, and then it starts to spill over. So it did that, and it started spilling over. And this spillway has, which was built about 40 years ago, had never been tested before. So nobody really understood whether it would hold, because when it was built, it hasn't been used since. So the idea that all of a sudden all of this water is filling up in the spillway to this area that had really, again, never been used before, I think that combined with the sheer amount of water is what caused some of this resettlement to go on. We don't know exactly why this hole punctured in the spillway, but we do know that it was an abundance of caution that local officials looked at it. They saw that there were 3.5 million acre feet of water. So that's enough water to feed 3.5 million suburban homes. And they said, we can't risk having a 30-foot wall of water come into this populated area. So they told everyone to get out.
Wow. Well, meanwhile, your colleague Dan Brecke there at KQED talked to people during this evacuation, 4:30 in the afternoon, little notice, Sunday night, people trying to get out. It sounded crazy.
Yeah, that's right. Dan was talking to people who all of a sudden, so you have about 200,000 people who now have to get out of an area that the infrastructure wise, you know, this is more rural California. This is just outside of Chico. It's about 140 miles northeast of San Francisco. So infrastructure wise, these roads are not as big. There's not a mass freeway system outside of Interstate 5 to get folks out. So they have to, you know, kind of go through these areas that are really contracted traffic-wise. And Brecke spoke to a guy named Philip Haar, and Philip Haar said there was a lot of confusion.
All my neighbors start going crazy outside. You think it was like a zombie apocalypse out there, where people were running, trying to get out of Dodge.
And as people were making this mad scramble, Robin, people who were disabled were actually left behind. I want you to hear something from Marilyn McKinney. Her family was left waiting for help.
My daughter-in-law is still there with her sister, who is bedridden, but we've got her in a wheelchair. They were supposed to be sending an ambulance or someone to help transport her out, and nobody has shown up for her yet.
So as you can hear, Robin, there was a lot of confusion and a lot of, to be honest with you, some panic and some heartache as people tried to get out of this area.
Well, John, first of all, please keep us posted on what happened to Marilyn McKinney's daughter-in-law and her sister, you know, who tried calling 911. Let us know what happened there. But meantime, there seems to be good news that the water is receding.
The water is receding, but there are storms that are coming in the back end. And again, we're talking about 900 feet of water. That's a lot of pressure. And the idea that more water is going to come in, plus, you know, this area collects water not just from what falls from the sky, but also from the Sierra Nevada, the runoff that comes from there, and the snow is melting much faster than it normally does. So the snow fell, it is turning into liquid much more quickly, filling up, you know, the river basins and ending up here. So what we're hoping for is that the water falls, it's fallen about a foot since yesterday, it needs to fall 49 more feet. And once that happens, it should be a lot safer. So we're
hoping that all?
About 7 or 8 Shaquille O'Neals, no big deal. So once that water falls that far, then it should be a lot safer. But again, with the storms, with the snow runoff, we're concerned that that's not going to happen. And so we haven't seen the evacuation order lifted.
Right. And your governor there, Jerry Brown, has an emergency order. There are shelters that have been set up at fairgrounds. Quite the scene there in Northern California. John Sepulveda, host of the California Report, on Here Now, contributor to KQED, keeping an eye on it for us. John, thank you.
Thank you.
This next segment may not be appropriate for all listeners. The new documentary, I Am Jane Doe, tells the stories of victims of American child sex trafficking. And what happens to these children is truly shocking. Here's Seattle lawyer Eric Bauer describing what happened to a young person he represents.
She was right out of 7th grade, and she was trafficked for a long time and very heavily, getting raped on a daily basis by upwards of 20 adults a day, having at these 7th grade kids any way they want. And that happens, and it's real.
It's real, and yes, it is everywhere, largely due to the internet and sites like Backpage.com. Backpage is the second largest online classified site in the United States, second only to Craigslist. A 2017 U.S. Senate report found that Backpage supports the vast majority, some 80% of all sex advertising online. Now, much of that is legal, but as the documentary I Am Jane Doe reveals, there are hundreds of thousands of young children who are also trafficked on the site. And several of those young victims and their families have sued Backpage.com. 3 young Jane Does from Boston took their case all the way to the United States Supreme Court. But last month, the court decided not to hear their case, so a lower court ruling stands. It found that Backpage.com is not liable for the content on the site. I spoke recently with the mother of one of the young women in the Boston lawsuit. We're calling her Sarah Lowe to protect her daughter's identity. And Sarah started by telling us more about her daughter.
My daughter is a very sweet, big heart, talented young woman. And she's just a great person,
yeah.
A great young lady.
How old was she when she was first exploited?
15.
What happened?
I dropped her off at her friend's house, and they were going to go to the mall together. And she had a time to be home, and she was to let us know when she was coming home because she was going on the T. And we would pick her up from the train station. And as hours had gone by, we were calling her. We couldn't get in touch with her. She wasn't answering her cell phone. We're texting her. I was trying to find her, calling the cell phone company, seeing if they can put a trace on her phone, doing things like the family locator on her phone, and it just had her everywhere, places that I couldn't figure out while she was in so many different places on her phone. I was looking up, like, her last phone calls, had gone online, checking her cell phone to see, like, who was the last person she called or who was the last person who called her. 2 men I spoke with said that they got my daughter's phone number from Backpage. I had no idea what that was. I had gone online to see what Backpage was, and I searched up her phone number, and then that's where I saw pictures of my daughter. They were pretty much, you know, it was really inappropriate. I don't know how else to explain it, but there were pictures of her in underwear and a bra.
So this was all in less than 24 hours?
Yes. And we didn't hear from her until the next day, the next morning.
And when you did hear from her, what?
We started to get ready to go to the police station. And once we actually got outside to the car, my daughter texted us and said, I'm in the house. So she'd been dropped off. And we didn't really know exactly what happened to her because she wouldn't talk to us or tell us what happened. So, you know, we still don't know where she was or who she was with. And we ended up bringing her to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and, you know, I can only imagine the frenzy of the hours that you were trying to figure out what happened to your daughter. And you said you had never heard of this thing called Backpage.
Mm-hmm.
But once you did and you saw the ad, did you try to reach out to the company?
I did. I emailed them telling them to remove the pictures, that my daughter was a minor. And I had to email them several times to even get a response back from them. And they still didn't take the pictures down.
I can't even imagine what my response would be if I saw an ad like that for a child of mine.
Mm-hmm.
How did you respond to that?
Well, I was very angry. I was hurt. And I'm saying, how did this happen? Did, you know, even the question, like, did she put these pictures on here herself? Because I didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
You know? And you just go through so many different emotions. But I mean, hurt mostly, you know, because even I know that the two people I had spoken to were grown men. I was so angry. I really was just so angry just to even think, like, how could this happen?
Now, forgive me for asking this, but when you took her to the hospital, did they tell you what they were able to tell you about?
We didn't really understand or know, because she wasn't talking to us, to me or to my husband. She wasn't really talking to anyone. So I did not fully understand what happened to my daughter until months later. I started doing research on my own and gave everything that I found to the police.
Yeah.
And then they were able to find the person who put my daughter on Backpage.
So can you tell me, like, what did happen to her?
I know that she was picked up from her friend's house by two people, a man and a woman. She did ask to go home, and they wouldn't take her home.
Did she know who they were?
The only thing I know is she was introduced to them by someone else, and she, I believe, was talking to them online.
Mm.
They pretty much kidnapped her. They took her to a hotel where a man was waiting for her, and he raped her. And then they brought her home.
I'm so sorry. How's she doing today?
She's doing better, but it's been a rough road. You know, she suffers from depression, PTSD. She's been in and out of the hospital over time, but she's doing a lot better. Not so much to me, but she's able to talk about the issue where before she wouldn't. She was able to, you know, graduate high school. It was a rough road,
yeah.
You know, but getting her the help she needs and just really supporting her. This lawsuit really helped her a lot. It makes her feel, and the movie, you know, mm-hmm. It just makes her feel more like she's in control.
So that's one young girl's story. Others are told in the documentary film, I Am Jane Doe. I spoke with filmmaker Mary Mazzio about how the website Backpage became America's biggest sex trafficking website.
It's really fascinating. They created this website that at first I think they tried to legitimately filter content.
Mm-hmm.
And you see internal memos saying if you see the word young in an ad, let's report it to the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Let's report it. 2 days later, we're losing too much business. If it's young, let it through. And then over time, you see this evolution. You delete the ad, right? There would be instructions to moderators only if you are very, very, very sure it is a minor. So what happened was there was an evolution over time around revenue. Let's call it what it is.
How much revenue are we talking about?
So the Senate reports that in 2015, the site was making in excess of $150 million a year. This is hidden in plain sight, and the fact that it has been able to con- to really operate in an unfettered way has been remarkable. And the federal judiciary has protected Backpage at every step.
Well, we should note that the lawsuit that the Boston Jane Does brought made it, you know, through the federal court system, but the United States Supreme Court has elected not to hear the case. So, Mary, what does that mean?
So it means that the decision of the First Circuit Court of Appeals, where, by the way, Justice Souter sat in, right, former U.S. Supreme Court judge, the First Circuit said a website operator can profit, can encourage, can participate in this federal crime. But because of Section 230, because it's third-party content, sorry. You, Jane Doe, you children lose.
I mean, is that the First Circuit's way of saying this is a problem that can't be solved in the court, that it has to go back to Congress?
Precisely. And, of course, we have been speaking with members of Congress, and they said, how can federal judges be saying this is congressional intent? We never intended for this to happen. Congress has to step up and alter Section 230. And this is going to be a big fight because the tech companies have, for 20 years now, enjoyed this immunity, an expanded immunity for third-party content. And as far as I'm concerned, it's corporate welfare.
And one last thing. Sarah Lowe, the mother of one of the victims that you heard from a little earlier, well, she's vowed to continue her fight to hold Backpage liable for its role in facilitating sex trafficking.
They have to be held responsible because these kids are going through, it's torture. And my daughter's, you know, forever traumatized, even if she is getting older and she's doing better. But that's always something that she's going to have to live with. And they have to be held responsible. Something has to be done. I can't believe that there are laws that are set in place where kids can be sold and raped.
That's Sarah Lowe. I also spoke with Mary Mazzio, filmmaker of the documentary I Am Jane Doe.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
The White House is weighing the next move to try to reinstate President Trump's temporary travel bans on all refugees and visitors from 7 majority Muslim countries, an indefinite ban on Syrian refugees. The White House lost its appeal to a federal court, which upheld Washington State's stay of the travel bans. That state's attorney general arguing, in part, that the order would harm Washington State's economy. While other states could make a similar argument, Georgia is home to Fortune 500 companies, refugee resettlement agencies, and universities that attract students and faculty from around the world. Sean Powers from Here Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
J.D. McCrary heads the Atlanta office for the International Rescue Committee. It's a resettlement organization. McCrary says the last few weeks have been a whirlwind for many of the people he's trying to help.
We are counseling our clients, you know, on making sure that they adjust their status to lawful permanent resident as soon as possible, and if they're eligible, to pursue citizenship. And we are providing counseling to those who have been separated from their family.
McCrary says he serves more than 4,000 people a year in Georgia. About a fourth are newly arrived refugees. His agency gets federal funding for each new arrival. The city of Clarkston in DeKalb County is a destination for many of these people. It's been described as the Ellis Island of the South. Mayor Ted Terry says his community would take a direct economic hit if refugees couldn't settle there.
A large part of the economy is based around the rent, the utilities, the money spent at grocery stores. And then the good news is that after 180 days, 91% of these refugees are self-sufficient, so they have a job.
I'm Birendra Dakal, and I'm originally from Bhutan.
Clarkston residents shared stories of coming to the U.S. at a recent town hall meeting.
15 years' time, I consider myself a lucky man because all my children are now successful. They are highly educated. They are professionals. I myself is earning some $10 per hour, and I consider myself a lucky man. Because I was a refugee, I didn't have $10 in my pocket when I came to this country.
Businesses that employ refugees and immigrants are also keeping a close eye on President Trump's executive order. For example, there's Atlanta-based Coca-Cola. In a statement, CEO Muhtar Kent called the travel ban contrary to Coke's core values and beliefs. Atlanta immigration attorney Kim Thompson works for the national labor and relations firm Fisher Phillips. She says she's been advising businesses to ask employees some tough questions.
What their nationality is, where they were born, and determine whether it's actually mission critical for someone to travel outside the U.S.
But the travel ban does create opportunities, says former Georgia Congressman Jack Kingston. He worked on Donald Trump's campaign. Kingston says Georgia-based organizations affected by the ban could take this opportunity to present their own ideas for improving the security of international travel.
We've had a very significant refugee crisis, and what the Trump administration is trying to balance national security, human crisis, and immigration security. So this is part of his comprehensive approach.
That approach comes as the Trump administration considers other proposals to limit immigration. Meanwhile, Georgia Senator David Perdue has proposed cutting the number of legal immigrants to the U.S. in half. For Here and Now, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
The war in Afghanistan, America's longest war, is at a stalemate. That's what Army General John Nicholson, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, told the Senate Armed Services Committee last week. General Nicholson said thousands of additional troops will be needed to break the stalemate.
Our number one goal is to protect the homeland from any attack emanating from the region. And of course, we have achieved that in the last 15 years. However, we need to stay on top of it because of this confluence of 20 terrorist groups in the region. I believe this is an enduring commitment to keep pressure on these groups and help the Afghans move towards a successful end state.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. His recent op-ed about Afghanistan appeared in the National Interest magazine. It's headlined, "The Threat America is Neglecting in Afghanistan." Michael, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, so Michael, as you write in your op-ed, President Trump has said very little about Afghanistan, but of course General Nicholson had plenty to say. What struck you about his testimony before the Armed Services, the Senate Armed Services Committee?
Well, I was struck about how explicit he was about the need for more troops. He was very clear that there have been some successes, there's been progress in terms of the Afghan security forces. But he said again and again that, you know, we're going to need thousands of more U.S. troops to be in that country to try to help. And of course, it's not necessarily the most politically popular thing to say in the United States, where there's been a fair amount of war weariness for quite a few years.
I mean, that's putting it mildly. I would say after 16 years, it's exactly the news that nobody wants to hear.
Right. Though, unfortunately, I think we do need to hear it. I always am a bit conflicted. On the one hand, an analyst of South Asia and of Afghanistan. But again, as an American citizen, from the perspective of an analyst, things are really in bad shape in Afghanistan. I mean, as General Nicholson had said, you know, you've got a number of terrorist groups there that are causing all kinds of damage. The Afghan security forces need a lot of help. You know, you have that on the one hand. You have a resurgent Al-Qaeda. You have a local faction of ISIS that should not be taken lightly. So you have all that, and that suggests a need to have more U.S. support, if nothing else, to provide a psychological boost to the Afghan forces. But on the other hand, as a U.S. citizen, I mean, I myself am very concerned about, after all these years, after all the U.S. troops that have died, we still don't really know why U.S. troops are in Afghanistan and, in some cases, dying in Afghanistan. It costs a lot of money to maintain U.S. troops in that country. You know, you hear that at one point it would cost about $1 million per year to have one U.S. troop in Afghanistan. So a lot of it, there's a conflict between, you know, being an analyst on the one hand and then being a U.S. citizen. It's really hard to square that circle.
So let's dig into this a little deeper here, because there's a lot in what you just said. So first of all, in that tape that we heard, General Nicholson says there's a confluence of 20 terrorist groups in the region. Why is it, after, you know, 16 years of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan, that has been able to happen? Why have they been able to find sanctuary there?
Well, I'm glad that he made that point, simply because there's been a narrative in Washington over the last few years that Al-Qaeda has essentially been decimated in the Afghanistan and Pakistan region, and that the attention is really turned to other parts of the world. But the bottom line is, it's a very rough neighborhood, not just Afghanistan, but the broader region. In Pakistan, you have sanctuaries for a number of terrorist groups like the Haqqani Network and the Afghan Taliban. Al-Qaeda has never gone away. And you have a lot of other militant organizations in Pakistan and Afghanistan, also in Central Asia. They're all cut from the same cloth. They're all Islamist militant groups. They don't all necessarily want to target the same people or places, but they all have differing levels of collaboration and, in many cases, are loyal to Al-Qaeda. That's the bottom line.
Now, how different is this than, in the late 90s, early 2000s?
Clearly, things have gotten worse in terms of the number of attacks and the potency of different terrorist groups. Obviously, it was a very different situation in the 1980s and the 1990s, where in Afghanistan, you had a variety of groups that were fighting, that had been fighting against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. After the Soviets left and after the Americans stopped being involved in the region, things got very complicated. There was a long and horrifically bloody civil war that culminated in as you know, the Taliban holding power for a number of years. And then, of course, you got to a point where a few years later the United States entered and really did achieve its major objective right from the start, which was essentially to remove the Al-Qaeda sanctuaries. Al-Qaeda had been very happily hosted by the Taliban. But I think it's as the years went by, it was just easier for a number of different terror groups to exploit the very troubled security environment in this country.
Well, I mean, so is part of that because of the fact that the United States strategy largely involved training Afghan security forces, and clearly they're not fully ready to take full control of that mission. I mean, General Nicholson said explicitly that the U.S. has an enduring commitment, in his words, to keep pressure on the groups and to continue to help the Afghans move towards a successful end state. Why is it that the Afghan military, after all these years, still can't do that on its own?
Well, it's a question that's very hard to answer. Of course, we're starting from a very low base here, that the notion of central security and national security institutions in Afghanistan is somewhat new. The fact that you have a national army, national police force, these really weren't around for the most part in previous years. So it takes a very long time to get to a point where these institutions become truly self-sufficient. But I think the fact of the matter is the enemy and the challenges that the Afghan security forces face are so formidable that it's really difficult and really unfair to expect these fledgling troops and police forces in Afghanistan to be able to essentially ease, if not end, the insurgency altogether anytime soon. And there are also external factors at play here as well. I mean, the fact of the matter is you have sanctuaries in Pakistan for the chief combatants of the insurgency in Afghanistan. The bottom line at the end of the day is that you do have these external factors as well that complicate the effort to stabilize the country.
So Michael Kugelman, let me ask you, honestly, given everything you just said, how long will the United States, how long will NATO, should they be involved in Afghanistan? I mean, as we talked about earlier, the appetite is not necessarily there, but the situation you're describing makes me think that, there's every chance that the United States should remain involved in the region for decades.
You know, when people in Washington, in the analytical community, and those that are really paying attention to this war, when they start talking about time frames, I'm not talking about official Washington, I'm talking about those outside of the government, when we talk about how long it could take, the parallel that tends to come up is the Colombia insurgency and the fact that that took decades.
It took a half century.
It took a half a century to resolve. So unfortunately, if that analogy ends up being true, then you may have to think about a 50-year period. And I just don't see that at all politically palatable in this country. Quite frankly, my own view is that it would be wise to send in to send in several thousand more troops, not to fight a war, but to supplement the advising and the training. But I think that there needs to be some very clear-cut objectives put out there by the Trump administration to suggest what needs to be done. I'm not saying there need to be time frames put out there, but there needs to be clear-cut objective put out there by the U.S. government as to, you know, what the troops in Afghanistan should be doing. And that way it'll be easier to measure after a certain amount of time if things aren't being done according to how they're supposed to be done per the objectives that are set. It may be easier to think about next steps. But you know, at the end of the day, what General Nicholson said about trying to protect the U.S. homeland from what could be done in Afghanistan, you know, it may be a bit of an exaggeration there, but it is very true that if the U.S. simply turns its back on Afghanistan, you could have conditions set into place where the security situation in Afghanistan deteriorates significantly enough that you could have more and more sanctuaries carved out in Afghanistan in which the Taliban can once again invite al-Qaeda forces in there to start trying to plan an attack in the United States. Once again, I don't want to be a doomsayer, but we should not rule out that possibility. And that in of itself, in my view, justifies the need for a continued, though not necessarily permanent, U.S. commitment to Afghanistan.
Well, Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Many people may be asking today, who is Stephen Miller? We know he's the 31-year-old senior policy advisor to President Trump, who yesterday got into tussles over his false claims of voter fraud. Here's an exchange with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
You can't hold on a second. You just claimed again that there was illegal voting in New Hampshire. People bust in from the state of Massachusetts. Do you have any evidence to back
anybody,
that up?
I'm saying anybody, George, go to New Hampshire, talk to anybody who's worked in politics there for a long time. Everybody's aware of the problem in New Hampshire with respect to
I'm asking you as the White House senior I'm asking you as the White House senior policy advisor. The president made a statement saying he was the victim of voter fraud, people
and
being bust from Massachusetts
and
New Hampshire. Do you have any evidence?
Well, Stephen Miller did not have any evidence. Election experts say there is none. But afterwards, President Trump tweeted, "Congratulations, Stephen Miller, on representing me this morning on the various Sunday morning shows. Great job." Glenn Thrush is White House correspondent for The New York Times. He joins us by Skype. And Glenn, we know Miller was a top aide to Senator Jeff Sessions long before Sessions became attorney general. In fact, it was Miller who brought Sessions into the Trump camp early on. You spoke with congressional aides about Stephen Miller. What did they say?
Stephen Miller was best known as the guy who would spam your inbox with a ton of these bombastic clips, little mini speeches, emails from his boss that was pushing against the notion that any kind of comprehensive immigration reform is anything other than amnesty. And he was regarded really as a gadfly by a lot of his colleagues. But, you know, we're in a point in history where his version of economic populism and his vision on immigration matches so closely with the president's that he is now one of the top three or four advisors in the West Wing.
Yeah. Well, he grew up in liberal Santa Monica and turned on his parents' liberalism there, wrote an essay about his conservative views in high school called How I Changed My Left-Wing High School, because he did get them to say the Pledge of Allegiance when they weren't, went on to Duke University. But was he the author, you say how much immigration means to him, was he the author of President Trump's bans on immigration and refugees?
I think it was a collective effort. I think you've got to look at a sort of a West Wing within a West Wing over there. And he is very close to the former Breitbart news editor and man about town, Steve Bannon, and four or five aides in the West Wing right now who share this opinion, sort of on hardline immigration opinion. During the 2014 stunning upset victory by Dave Brott over Eric Cantor, who was then House Majority Leader in a suburban Richmond, Virginia district, that group really got together. And we're talking about people like radio host Laura Ingraham and Julia Hahn from Breitbart News. So that effort, in a lot of ways, served as a launching pad for all these folks.
Well, but before that, Stephen Miller went to Duke University, came to national attention because he commented on the three white lacrosse players falsely accused of rape by a black woman. He spoke about a nation paralyzed by racial paranoia. This is what brought him to the attention of President Trump's now chief strategist, but former Breitbart head Steve Bannon, you know, so somewhat kindred spirits there. But was he a white nationalist? Because Richard Spencer, the white separatist, white nationalist, who made his name in part through Breitbart News when it was run by Bannon, says that he mentored Stephen Miller at Duke University.
Now, Miller denies that he was mentored, but he says that he had a brief association with him when they were both on the Young Conservatives Union. And, of course, what's really interesting about this is Stephen Miller was raised as a conservative slash reform Jew in suburban Los Angeles. So, you know, that's a little bit of a paradox. But a lot of the larger thematic positions that President Trump has and are espoused by people like Spencer on the right, or this quote-unquote alt-right, I think a lot of these views dovetail almost seamlessly with what Mr. Miller is doing in the West Wing with the president. Steve Bannon has likened himself over the course of the years as a Lenin-type figure who broke into the palace and took it over. But at some point in time, they're going to have to start dealing with Congress, and they're going to start having to use the presidency as a platform to cross over and get public support. Will Mr. Miller be able to make that transition? Will President Trump be able to make it with him? I think that remains to be seen.
Well, Glenn Thrush, another thing that remains to be seen, how soon it will be before he shows up on Saturday Night Live, as you did. So while we have you, we just have to ask, though, there was the skit Saturday night, Melissa McCarthy playing Press Secretary Sean Spicer, calling you out, even for your signature fedora hat. You, of course, played in the scene by SNL player Bobby Moynihan. Let's listen.
Now I'm going to open it up for questions, and I'm going to probably freak if you start asking stupid ones. Speaking of freaks and stupid ones, Glenn Thrush, New York Times. Stupid hat, go!
Stupid hat?
Look, I just wanted to know.
Look, is this homage, or is this like, are you thinking, God, it is a stupid hat?
I don't think it's a stupid hat. I have to say one thing. I've never worn a hat in the briefing room. I have to say, it's an out-of-body experience having to see yourself on a show that you've been watching since you're 8 years old. But my kids are really getting a big kick out of it, so I guess it's okay.
Glenn Thrush, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Glenn, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. When McCarthy as Spicer drove the podium into the crowd of reporters, he could have gotten hurt. Wait, it wasn't really him. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.